I'm Christopher Lydon with Rick Perlstein, the hyperkinetic close reader of politics just yesterday. The Invisible Bridge is his third big brick of a book. It's an 800-page magnifying glass on just three abysmal years between Richard Nixon's second inauguration in 1973, his Watergate downfall in 74, Ronald Reagan's near-miss revolt against Gerald Ford, and then Jimmy Carter's rise to the White House, all in that grumpy bicentennial year of 1976. I'm hooked here because these were the years when, A, I covered national politics for the New York Times, and B, we can see looking back that something else was going sour in American life. The falloff in middle-class incomes, the no-lessons-learned retreat from Vietnam, the forking now 40-year trend to inequality. I'm engaged here with Rick Perlstein before a summer Sunday crowd at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston. And we're testing our takes on that 70s story, especially on the figures Carter and Reagan, who would shoot it out in 1980. At the outset, it was Nixon on top of the world.
The book starts in January of 1973. Richard Nixon, who was one, of course, a dazzling landslide victory, biggest plurality ever, who basically directed, as we know now, a successful cover-up of the White House's connection, not just to the Watergate burglaries, but the cover-up of the crime and paying off the defendants and all that sort of thing, is looking forward to a brilliant second term. Economy is doing pretty good, surprisingly enough. He submits a budget, which there's a lot of debate over whether Nixon was a conservative or not. There's no question to me, in my mind, that looking at his budget that he submitted for FY 1973, he intended to tack hard to the right. Newsweek called it the most important document since the New Deal. And he was popular. And he goes on TV right after his re-inauguration, and announces, "The Vietnam War is over, we've achieved peace with honor." And the prisoners of war who have been the subject of much, much, much worry and concern and publicity are gonna come home. And things very soon turn south. First, the trial of the Watergate burglars, five of them, and two of their bosses, Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy, which are tried in a very narrow indictment, which is, shows the success of the cover-up, only for this break-in, and only those seven people. They've contained it. And there's an incredible break in the case, and there's this really annoying judge that a lot of the kind of pundits in Washington are really embarrassed by, Judge Sirica, who insists on like kind of badgering these witnesses and saying, "Who gave you the money?" and all these things that seem kind of beyond his brief. And people were asking him at cocktail parties about whether he was on the McGovern campaign payroll and why can't he just leave well enough alone. And then this guy, James McCord, posts a letter directly to the judge. He's one of the defendants. He was the head of security for the committee to re-elect the president, the aptly named Creep, and says, basically, "I've been threatened, I've been paid off, and this thing goes all the way to the top." And very soon after that, the televised hearings, which were authorized 98-0 in the Senate, which never would have won 98-0 had people not presumed that nothing would make a connection to the White House, open up, and every day, suddenly, Americans are discovering that the people with whom they've entrusted the people's house, the people's mansion, the White House, are running it like mafia dons. Very soon after that, in the spring, meat prices. Housewives begin boycotting meat. For the Memorial Day weekend, people are talking about rationing of gasoline. So we have the first hints of an energy crisis, which is profoundly disconcerting because people don't even know that energy is something that you can have a shortage of. It's just a new concept. Energy is what you breathe. You know, what's the most American pastime? You know, your 20-foot Cadillac driving across, you know, until your eyeballs bleed. And then finally, we have Vietnam. And this humiliation of America, obviously, despite what Nixon says, having lost its first war. And turn by turn, a remarkable bipartisan investigation, first by the Senate Watergate Committee, and then impeachment proceeding by the House Judiciary Committee, sees Nixon resigning. Gerald Ford promises our long national nightmare is over, but 1 month later, well, something very important happens. It's the first political debate I can remember in kindergarten. I did not live through these events. I was born in 1969. This is not my life.
Poor thing.
But I remember going to kindergarten, and we were arguing at the top of our lungs about something that happened a month after the Nixon resignation, which was, of course, whether Evel Knievel had pulled his parachute on purpose when he jumped over the Snake River Canyon. Nothing seems to be going right in America. All our heroes are kind of sailing straight into the canyon floor below. But, of course, Ford pardons Nixon, and people think the jig is up. Everything's rigged. Ford, who has promised to run this transparent administration, obviously did this in a dirty deal. And the next year after that, in 1975, there are actually 83 terrorist bombings in American soil. People are terrified to have a bicentennial celebration, not only because it doesn't seem like there's anything to celebrate. The poll numbers are astonishing. The apathy is astonishing. That was the article that I quoted Christopher Lydon on. He did an article about how no one was voting in the primaries. Not only that, in 1975, you have the Church Committee hearings, which not only investigate the CIA, and it's discovered that the CIA is basically running assassination squads of foreign leaders, it investigates the FBI. And the same day Ronald Reagan announces that he's going to run for president in 1975 against Gerald Ford, it's revealed that the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, basically sent Martin Luther King a dossier of wiretaps that were intended to get him to commit suicide. And also, a lot of people remember this, the Church Committee, very much against the president's wishes, investigates the NSA, something that Americans hadn't heard of. You know, the joke was no such agency. That was the NSA. And that's how it was learned that the NSA, the telegraph companies, remember telegraphs? They were before our internet, was at the end of every business day was handing over the day's telegraph traffic overseas to the government completely illegally. By the way, after the Martin Luther King investigation, during the press conference, after Nixon announces he's doing something incredible and unprecedented, running against a sitting president, has not lost his party's nomination since Chester Arthur, someone asks him in the press conference about the day's headlines about the FBI and Martin Luther King. Reagan has consistently said that these investigations are terrible for America. He was on a commission, the Rockefeller Commission, to investigate the FBI after a Seymour Hersh article revealed that the CIA had spied illegally on 10,000 Americans. And Reagan says, well, I didn't read the morning papers. And that's really the narrative arc of this book. Things like the Church Committee investigation, the Watergate investigation, the beginnings of a real conservation movement, which people are thinking hard about what it might mean to be energy independent, a serious debate about whether America could any longer be the world's policeman. You get things like when the POWs come home, columnists like Jimmy Breslin, very popular columnist in the New York Daily News, says, why is everyone making a big fuss about these POWs coming home? It reminds me of the time I was waiting for a friend of mine to come home from Sing Sing. These people were war criminals bombing civilians. Now, I think if the Nation published that now, they might get in trouble. There was this real level of civic engagement in which people were really beginning to look hard, even at the level of popular culture, even on a show like MASH, where the good guys were the people who didn't follow orders. And the comic butt of the joke was the guy who was the spit and polish kind of John Wayne character, Frank Burns, who was, of course, a clown in the show. We were really beginning to kind of, in my estimation, grow up as a nation and really think hard about what it would mean to not proceed as if we were God's chosen nation. And the arc I show is that every turn of this new reality also had a kind of antithesis, and that was kind of the Reaganite sort of ascension in which people began to say, why do we need to run the American people down? Why do we need to always be apologizing for America? And that struggle between two definitions of patriotism, the traditional one and the new definition of patriotism that's rising in the 70s, which says the true patriot is the guy who is willing to acknowledge the sins of his country in order to make it better, are really kind of locked in this kind of political culture civil war.
This is also a book of extraordinary studies of people, most particularly Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter. I also want to direct us to sort of the big theme of what was happening in American public life and American power in this odd transition from Nixon collapsing to Ford sort of inadequately holding the bag, although fending off Ronald Reagan, Reagan being defeated for the nomination in 76, but he comes back to haunt Jimmy Carter in 1980. I wish you'd give us your kind of direct sketch, Rick, of this eternal enigma of Ronald Reagan, the man himself, for whom, I got to tell you, I have a certain abiding affection and respect. It gives us this notion of that incredibly likable man who we all question whether he was really human in the end. Even his biographer, Edmund Morris, wondered, was this a real earthling or was this something else?
Right. Edmund Morris, of course, was Ronald Reagan's chosen biographer. And
the very distinguished biographer before that of Teddy Roosevelt.
Of Teddy Roosevelt, and this is very significant. This idea of this kind of hero on horseback who charged up San Juan Hills. And that was enormously attractive to Ronald Reagan for reasons that I think will become apparent. Ronald Reagan, of course, comes from a very chaotic home. His father was a serious alcoholic. He flitted from job to job. He was a failed shoe salesman, not just a shoe salesman, but a failed shoe salesman. This kind of blarneyful Irishman who was very quick-witted and kind of brash, but never really could amount to anything, moved his family from one rented house to the other. They finally settle in this town called Dixon, which claims itself as Reagan's hometown. Well, of course, he had no hometown, and even in Dixon, they were moving from rented home to rented home. And Ronald Reagan grows up knowing that kind of any morning his dad could be showing up in the paper for breaking the law. This is during Prohibition. He doesn't. My surmise is that might have had something to do with the fact that he was the police chief's pinochle partner. His mom is an inveterate do-gooder, almost like a martyr. And she's always over at the local hospital, ministering to people. There's even talk that Nell Reagan is a faith healer, but also very charismatic. Reagan imitated her voice, the modulation of her voice, how she was able to kind of create intimacy with her interlocutor by kind of talking low, making them listen in, but also had this very clarion voice. Someone said that I can always remember Nell Reagan calling her kids in a very theatrical way when it was time for dinner from the front porch. But she also would go to the local prison and would minister to the prisoners. And she was so respected and trusted in this role that she began boarding prisoners after their sentences were up in the family's sewing room. But imagine this. There's some recent ex-con in the family sewing room, and there's these two boys who are sleeping two to a bed. Right? And a biographer once pointed out, can you imagine how kind of strange this house was, of this Catholic drunk father, this fundamentalist mother, these prisoners coming in and out, and then finally we have this kind of lonely, scared kid who, in all of the descriptions we have of him from people who remember him before the age of 10 or so, is always kind of off by himself, playing with lead soldiers, or just kind of absent, whether even when he's present. If you look at pictures of Reagan, the very few pictures of Reagan, by the way, we didn't know he was going to be, you know, this world historic figure. At the age of, say, 9, there's a picture of him as a caddy, and he looks like what he is, a lonely, scared kid. If you look at him the next summer, in the same kind of picture of all the caddies at the Dixon Country Club, he looks like Ronald Reagan. He has a sparkle in his eye, his chest is straight. And one thing that we can hypothesize that happened in between is he got his library card, the Dixon Public Library, and he tells us the kind of books that he reads. Tarzan, Frank Merriwell of Yale, Horatio Alger, boys' adventure stories in which people from degraded circumstances, kids from degraded circumstances, kind of are transformed by both the gift of grace and their own kind of inner pluck into heroic rescuers, larger than life figures. We also know that he was absolutely obsessed with sports in a period, the 1920s, known as the golden age of sports, in which sports heroes like Babe Ruth, Red Grange, Jack Dempsey are gods on earth. I mean, it's amazing to read the sports writing by Grantland Rice.
Ronald Reagan is in many ways a child of Grantland Rice. The man who said, when the great scorekeeper comes to write against your name, he'll note not whether you won or lost, but how you played the game.
And Reagan, in an unattributed fashion, uses that quote in a college essay he writes, in which he literally analogizes a football player kind of rising from degraded circumstances and becoming the star to Jesus Christ's dark night of the soul in the Garden of Gethsemane when he's meditating with disciples about what he's about to face the next day on Calvary. Right. Mm. So these sports figures are kind of godlike figures. How do we know that this stuff sedimented itself so deeply in his mind? Well, I'll give you two examples. One is one from Ron Reagan's memoir, My Father at 100, which is a wonderful book. he emerged from this family and as a very wise and Zen-like kind of commentator on it. He says when his dad was completely racked with Alzheimer's, dementia, he would wake up in the middle of the night and he'd say, they need me, in a panicked voice. And as Ron Reagan points out, he wasn't saying they need me on the set at Warner Brothers with Betty Davis. They don't need me in the White House Situation Room. The guys in the locker room need me. Right? He was kind of imagining himself as a football hero. The other example I would give is in 1981. Chris, do you remember what he said to Nancy Reagan when he finally kind of came to after being shot?
Honey, I forgot to duck.
Right. And do you remember where that came from?
It wasn't Spencer Tracy, was it?
No, it was what Jack Dempsey said after he lost to whoever it was in a fight, by the way, in Yankee Stadium for 90,000 people. That's how big this stuff was.
I want to interrupt on the sports theme, but just to say we're being introduced to Ronald Reagan, the fantasist.
Yeah. Or maybe the guy who transcends the degraded circumstances the self-made man of the imagination. There's a positive spin.
Yes. I was thinking flying with Ronald Reagan west in that period when he was, before the convention in 76, he was going to the Mississippi convention. I asked him about his days with WHO, mm-hmm. I think,
in Des Moines.
Des Moines, Iowa. Okay. Ronald Reagan's job, one of his first out of college, was to relay baseball games of the Chicago Cubs, as I remember, mm-hmm. and he would get the ticker, which is all by number, identifying
the box score.
Exactly. It was sort of the running tape.
Yeah.
And it was Reagan's job to make a narrative out of it and make it fun.
In which he'd mix in the crowd noise.
Crowd noise and the ball hitting the bat and little sort of background on this slugger from Birmingham.
People presume that he was at the stadium.
Exactly. But I asked him, we were flying west, and I said, what about those days? And he could slip into it automatically with great pleasure.
He won the job by literally kind of reciting an entire game of, I think it was Northwestern versus Notre Dame, just kind of slipping into the play-by-play.
There was a certain limitation. He had the facts. So-and-so was out at third. But he could make a billow of dust and a heroic action out of it. It was tremendously entertaining to hear him do it, and he never outgrew it. I want to reverse engineer your Reagan a little bit to account for the things I liked about Ronald mm-hmm. Reagan and like about him at this moment. Colin Powell said after the White House years, but I said it before, that he'd never met anybody in public life with a deeper horror of nuclear weapons.
Right.
I believe Ronald Reagan was sort of our secret peacenik president all those years. As soon as the Marine barracks blew up in Beirut, we're out of here.
Right.
And we're going to beat up Grenada on the way home.
When I used
home.
To go on talk radio, I used to say, what would Ronald Reagan have done if he were caught in a religious civil war in the Middle East? He'd get out of there.
And he did. I've started a lot of arguments with the notion that he never remotely would have done what George W. Bush did in Iraq, which is also related to a theme, I better lay it out there, that when people talk about the nervous breakdown of the Republican Party, or they talk about extremism in the party mm-hmm. in the modern era, they're not talking about a legacy of Ronald Reagan. They're talking about a legacy of George W. Bush, who comes out of the Rockefeller, Eastern, moderate, but big oil, big Wall Street, big CIA mm-hmm. sense of imperial possession of the whole world. That was not Ronald Reagan's view. Account for the peacenik and then the rest
sure,
of Ronald Reagan.
Sure. I think that this sounds like a million miles from the question of geostrategy, but there's the Ronald Reagan who would always they would always have a selection of personal letters for him to read in the White House, right? Mm. And, the same day he, vetoed some, increase in, supplemental nutrition assistance or something like that, his heart would be so tugged by some story of someone who was hungry out in, Peoria, that he would literally get out his checkbook and write a check from Ronald Reagan and put it in the mail. And, of course, that's a moral failing, not being able to kind of do systematically what you're doing on the individual level. At the same time, he had this ability to kind of empathize with individual lives. That was kind of how he thought of war. And he also very much was driven by the idea of being a hero. And I've been toying with this more and more, and I haven't really kind of worked it out deeply. But of course, he was the first president to eliminate a class of nuclear weapons, intermediate range nuclear weapons through negotiation. He was the guy who went to Reykjavik and proposed to Gorbachev that they try to get rid of all nuclear weapons. He was the guy who only got in one teeny little arms skirmish in Grenada, which was kind of ugly because It really was intended to cover up the fact that they'd screwed up in Lebanon and the Marine barracks, that they left the gate down. And Reagan said, well, sometimes I leave the front door unlocked, you know. So there's lots to beat up on him for. And there's also the fact that he really does seem to have been very, very moved by watching The Day After. So this kind of Hollywood guy who really kind of was able to kind of interpret something in the lens of a really good story. But what I'm playing with is this idea that he could be history's hero if he got rid of the worst weapons that mankind has ever known. I think that was the kind of stage he had rehearsed himself playing on forever. You know, maybe he would have liked to have been Dwight David Eisenhower defeating Hitler, but these weapons kind of make conventional war unpractical.
But the identification of nuclear weapons as the nightmare comes early, before he was president.
Very interesting, yeah. And I wasn't aware of that.
Well, even in the farewell speech at the 76th
convention. Right, of course.
Nuclear weapons are a big thing.
He's writing something for a time capsule, and he says, when this time capsule is open, we'll know whether our generation has stood the test of peace or not.
Right. But he was also living in a world that basically accepted mutual assured destruction as a viable policy. I mean, it took a certain imagination, and I think courage on Ronald Reagan's part to say, no way, we're not going to live the rest of time
basically, it's this conservative distrust of experts, too, right? And the guys who are into the game theory stuff, it's people like Tom Schelling, these like kind of like Nobel Prize winning economists who are figuring out very complicated game theory schema and kind of almost mathematically proving that if you have a parity of nuclear weapons aren't going to be used. But he has a more, if you prefer, a literary understanding of human motivation. And Ronald Reagan's imagination when it came to achieving policy goals could be really remarkable. You remember a few years back, everyone was listening to, although his hagiographers have gotten YouTube to take it down, the video of the audio from the Nixon tapes of Nixon and Kissinger talking about how inconceivable it is that Ronald Reagan could ever become president. And if he was, that he'd probably start a nuclear war. Absolutely savage stuff. Well, not 2 years later, during the Yom Kippur War, when America airlifts all this weaponry to Israel during the Arab oil embargo, Nixon calls him because he's an important political figure that needs to be kind of assuaged. It's almost like a perfunctory political call. And it says, I have this problem. Egypt keeps on bragging about how many Israeli planes they're shooting down. And we know that they're lying. Maybe he was making small talk. This is after the tapes, so we don't know, but we have Kissinger's testimony of this in his memoirs. And Reagan, immediately, they hadn't thought of this, says, well, all we have to do is say we'll replace Israeli planes that Egypt claims to have shot down on a one-to-one basis. End of problem. It's this emotional intelligence he has, this ability to kind of solve problems by thinking himself into people's situations. And immediately, Henry Kissinger says, depicts himself saying, I wish I had someone that smart on my staff. That is not the Ronald Reagan we think about.
No, exactly. It's not the Ronald Reagan we've been sold in a way. But I think of another instance when at critical moments in 79, 80, he's running and the Soviets have moved into Afghanistan and there's a threat to the Persian Gulf. And people like James Schlesinger, even Brzezinski was saying we might have to go nuclear if the Soviets came closer. What was Ronald Reagan's response? No nukes. He said, well, we might have to put an embargo on Cuba, and we might have to invade Mexico and get their oil. But thank God, he said, there's more oil under Alaska than under all of the Persian Gulf. A pure nonsense. I mean, pure fantasy on his part. But it did express, to me, very tellingly, the Reagan view of a hemispheric continental power that lacked nothing, basically.
Yeah.
The last thing we were going to do, though, was to go to nuclear war over the oil supply, no matter what. And at the time, I knew what he was saying, and I thought the whole Carter notion, again, in retrospect of 40 years, of going to war in the Middle East at the drop of a hat was the wrong move. And Reagan had the sounder instinct.
And this was also the guy, by the way, who might recall this one, who told Menachem Begin publicly that they were creating a Holocaust in Lebanon. In his diary, he said he used that word deliberately. I mean, he was excoriated for that, but he also told Begin privately that the image of Israel around the world is now a baby with its arms blown off. He had a real ability to kind of get to people where they lived, which was a very powerful political thing. He was very different as a campaigner and as a executive. Governing is not a hero's profession. He was really at his best as a rhetorician and as a salesman when he was on the road campaigning. The conservatives consistently hated him when he was president, that he was every other month he was doing something to sell out conservatism.
Rick, the Jimmy Carter presidency comes in your next volume, but you get deep into it in this one. I covered Jimmy Carter early, and I stayed in his governor's mansion overnight. He's been to my house. I watched him carefully. But to me, looking back, and you touch on some of it, we got Carter almost entirely wrong, and the press got him wrong, and I think in many ways the people got him wrong. I say Reagan was a secret peacenik. Jimmy Carter was a Southern governor from a right-to-work state who had completely ignored both the civil rights crisis and the Vietnam War protest. He was a great friend of Martin Luther King Sr., Martin Luther King Sr., who had voted for Richard Nixon against John F. Kennedy. Talk about Jimmy Carter and what that confrontation represents.
Let me mention another name to start out with. Barack Obama. I like to say that both the right and the left converge in their opinions of Barack Obama and believing he must be some lefty because of his name and because of the color of his skin. But of course, he turns out to be a guy who's deeply tied into the establishment. Liberals feel sold out by his closeness to the bankers. It really kind of proves the old saw that the Republicans fall in line and Democrats fall in love. This idea of this kind of pure, clean Scirocco, kind of blowing in from Washington, from the provinces, who's not kind of compromised by their connection to the ossified old ways of doing things. This ability to kind of fall in love and then be disappointed over and over and over again. I was really struck by how well it stands the test of time when it comes to political tactics, but how poorly it stands the test of time when we think of the question of whether Jimmy Carter was a moral paragon. And not to take anything away from Carter's considerable achievements as a peacemaker himself, and his extraordinary ability to kind of bring light and salt as a post-president. The important thing for my book is this whole post-Watergate longing for innocence. In a lot of ways, he's Reagan's opposite, because as president, his kind of way of transcending the politics as usual was to precisely to ask hard questions, to demand stringent things of Americans, that they set down their thermostats and wear sweaters at home and that sort of thing. Putting solar panels in the White House that Ronald Reagan, you know, promptly takes down his first month in office. But really what they share in common and what they illuminate about the political culture in the time is this perennial American longing for innocence in a country that really kind of suffers profound trauma in its past, and division that we're always kind of believing that someone can magically deliver us from. It's that inability to kind of continue the work that I find so redemptive about, like the Watergate Committee or the generation of people who looked at Vietnam and said, let's not get into a counterinsurgency war, you know, 3,000, 10,000 miles away, or really think hard about whether our way of life is sustainable for the planet. That really kind of to leap across the invisible bridge, if you will, speaks to our inability to, say, call bankers to account in the financial crisis, to really do something about global warming. It's that Reaganite register. I tell a story in these interviews quite frequently about Samantha Power, a remarkable human rights activist and scholar who Barack Obama has named our UN representative. And I'm sure she's doing a great and noble job. But in order to get nominated, she had once written an article for, I believe, the New Republic, in which she pointed to lots of sins in America's past and said, we need to reckon with this, 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 and this. And she was asked about that article in her confirmation hearings by Senator Marco Rubio of Florida. And he said, what are these things that you believe America has to apologize for? And she responded, and this is a quote, America is the greatest nation in the world, and we have nothing to apologize for. Now, as long as formulations like that are de rigueur in our public life, that Reaganite register, I don't know how we can begin to solve the major structural problems that confront us. And that's the prehistory of how that came to be, is the story of this book and why I wrote this book.
Rick Perlstein's book is titled The Invisible Bridge. It's the third in his epic series, Inside Those Republican Icons, from Richard Nixon to Barry Goldwater to Ronald Reagan. And he's not done yet. Thanks to Amy McDonald, who introduced us at the Kennedy Library. Mary McGrath, with help from Connor Gillies, edited this conversation, which is never over until listeners like you check in with a comment at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of our Open Source podcast project.